The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
In the novel, what we seek to portray is a United States that still operates with a mental image of itself as able to do effectively whatever it wants. As we put in the book, driving donut holes in our neighbor's front yard. By 2034, which is when the novel is set, that time will be a time of danger for the United States.
I am Alex Vindman, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 15th, 2021. I sat down with retired Admiral James Sybrytis and Elliot Ackerman, the authors of 2034, a novel of the next world war. Admiral Sybrytis spent more than 30 years in the U.S. Navy, rising to the rank of four-star admiral. He was the Supreme Allied Commander at NATO and previously commanded the U.S. Southern Command, overseeing military operations in Latin America. He holds a PhD from the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, where he recently served 5 years as dean. Elliot Ackerman is the author of several novels, including Dark at the Crossing, which was the finalist for the National Book Award, and most recently, Waiting for Eden. He is both a former White House fellow and a Marine, and served 5 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, where he received the Silver Star, the Bronze Star for Valor, and the Purple Heart. We discussed the objective for writing a novel on the next world war, the lessons the novel offers national security professionals and policymakers, and key points in the backstory that precipitated the march to this fictional but highly realistic portrayal of the next world war. We also discussed important notions such as miscalculations and escalation spirals that commanders and policymakers must consider in the daily exercise of their most important duties, and the U.S. military's over-reliance on technology for warfighting. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 15th, 2034, a novel of the next world war. This is going to be the first opportunity for any of us to actually speak together, and I'm really looking forward to having this discussion over this excellent fictional account of the Third World War, 2034. I'll just jump straight in and ask an easy question. What was your objective in writing this book? Is this a cautionary tale about hubris, national exceptionalism, a kind of myopia that about an emerging vulnerability, or the risks of overreach in the midst of a relative decline?
I think it's both. I think you frame it pretty well. It is very much a cautionary tale. And when I conceived of this about 3 years ago, what was in my mind, Alex, was Cold War literature. So Dr. Strangelove, The Bedford Incident, The Third World War by Sir John Hackett. This kind of idea that you could put in front of the public a story of how terrible it would be if we were to sleepwalk into a war with China for both sides. And as I always say, there are no good guys and bad guys here. There's a villain, and that's war. And I think that this is a story of two nations who make mistakes, and nations are like people. They make mistakes and there are consequences. So that was kind of the frame of the idea. And then I went to my publisher and said, hey, I really want to write this novel. And they said, well, you know, Stavridis, this will be your 10th book, but you're not a novelist. And my editor said, but I know a novelist. So he connected me with Elliot Ackerman. Elliot, you want to pick up the story?
Yeah, well, we had known each other for a number of years. We're both alums of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. and where I was the writer in residence while Jim was the dean. And one of my collateral duties was to talk with the dean about books, which we did at great length. And so, you know, we had a friendship that was, you know, built out over books. We shared an editor at Penguin Press. And so, you know, when the idea of this collaboration came, you know, it seemed like a natural fit. We talked about, you know, where the book would go or the objectives for what type of story it would be. It seemed like we were in pretty close alignment in terms of the vision. And so we said, hey, let's see if we can write a first chapter. And we sat down and wrote that first chapter, and it was a real pleasure. And the rest was kind of history.
You know, I think we'll circle back to some of these kind of overarching themes that you wanted to communicate to the readers. And I think in part, not just to the general public, but I think you also had in mind to reach maybe some policymakers and influence their decision and thinking in certain areas. But I guess I should mention that as a retired officer, it was a little bit hard to read, especially as somebody that believes in American exceptionalism, to see the world shifting away from a U.S.-led world order. And part of it was that it was such a plausible a kind of account of a third world war that made it especially hard to kind of take in. Do you see this kind of outcome as inevitable given current trajectories?
Alex, I do not. Although it's interesting to me, our mutual friend, General Jim Mattis, had something of the same reaction you had when he and I chatted. And of course, he did a wonderful endorsement of the book, which I'm very proud to have on the cover. Here's my deal on this. I do not believe America is in decline in a massive way that will completely shift our nation. Another way to put it is, I don't think that our best days are behind us. I do think that as we emerge into this world of peer competition, which you wrestled with during your time at the National Security Council staff, it's clear that we have a particularly formidable competitor in China. And so I think it's logical to imagine our way into a future where China has many warships, has control of hypersonic missile technology, has advanced stealth, has supreme cyber capability. I don't think that's a stretch in the 15-year future. And as I think about the United States, we are still going to have many of our advantages. Our geography is enviable, benign neighbors to the north and south, great oceans, east and west. Our university systems, I think, will continue to be the envy of the world in many ways. Our Silicon Valley, our entrepreneurial spirit, this millennial generation that we all know fought these forever wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, our natural resources, our vast arable land, fresh water. We've got a lot going for us. In fact, I think very few, if any, other nation would actually trade places with us. But all of that is a long way of saying we're still very capable. We are not the only superpower, and we're going to have to come to grips with competing with China. And hopefully that won't end us up in a situation where we decide we go to war with China. That would be a mistake for both countries.
So it's a very interesting idea that basically takes a balanced look at U.S. strengths and U.S. vulnerabilities, entering back into a multipolar world with near-peer adversaries. What I read into this is that, you know, in this particular account, in 2032, the U.S. lost the conflict way before shots were fired in the South China Sea. There were some specific missteps along the way preceding 2032 that had to occur in order for the kind of outcome that we see in the text. Admiral, could you talk about that? And Elliot, talk about those kinds of shortcomings?
I'll start very quickly. Having commanded destroyers in the South China Sea, having command of a carrier strike group of a squadron of destroyers, I think I understand pretty well exactly what it's like to be in those situations. And I would say that in the novel, what we seek to portray is a United States that still operates with a mental image of itself as able to do effectively whatever it wants. As we put in the book, driving donut holes in our neighbor's front yard. By 2034, which is when the novel is set, that time will be a time of danger for the United States. And it's critical, therefore, here's the practical punchline, that we maintain at least a parity, if not superiority, in things like artificial intelligence, machine learning, quantum computing, unmanned vehicles. I'm very concerned that our narrow margin in those areas is declining. That ought to concern us all.
I would only add one of the themes that kind of runs through the book is, you know, what is America's place in the world? And, you know, we right now are at the end of what you could certainly say was an American century. And that century, you know, the 20th or really, you know, the past 100 years was defined by two world wars and the global structures that came out of those wars. And those were two wars that the United States did not start, but the United States certainly finished, and we were the beneficiaries of those conflicts. So one of the questions in 2034, which is a war that is started by the United States and China, is, you know, who ends that war, and how do they and how do other nations benefit from the conflict? It was a through line throughout the book, that question of how did this sort of reshuffle the deck of nations' power structures with regards to one another.
It's interesting that you're the most important enabler that the Chinese had amongst all those near peer capabilities was AI and cyber capability that allowed them to basically, with a turn of a switch, neutralize some of the things that we take for granted. Communications, ability to use precision guided munitions, navigation, all these tools. But the war itself was fought out in traditional domains, a maritime domain, and ultimately a nuclear exchange. I guess I'm curious as to your views on how decisive is the cyber domain? Is it, would you see it as a key enabler, or is it potentially maybe also the decisive domain in which this could actually be fought out? You know, the Chinese seem to have an option to shut off larger portions of the grid rather than conduct nuclear strikes. Why did you choose a more conventional nuclear versus a much more potent cyber exchange?
I think both are inherently part of the warfighting scenario in 2034. And in that story, I think Alex is yet to be written, which is how are these capabilities integrated? I always say, to go to an area of the world you know well, I always say that when Georgia was invaded in 2008 by Russia, that conflict will go down in history because it was the first time a truly kinetic attack, rockets, bombs, troops, tanks, was coupled with a very capable cyber attack. It was the first time. It won't be the last time. And I think that even by 2034, it'll be a mix of the tool sets. What is that great quote by Einstein you have deployed, Elliot? Help me.
I'll share the anecdote too. It's, You know, Alex, I work a lot as a journalist as well, and I covered the Syrian civil war. And in late 2013, I was down on the Turkish-Syrian border and wound up meeting a former member of Al-Qaeda in Iraq who had just fled. And so we sort of sat down, you know, two veterans of the Iraq war, but we'd fought on different sides. And he, in our conversation, rolled out the Einstein quote the Admiral was mentioning, which is that the Third World War will be a nuclear war, but the Fourth World War will be fought with sticks and stones. And then that former member of Al-Qaeda in Iraq looked at me and he said, you know, that's how we beat you guys in Iraq. It was with sticks and stones. So again, we talk about some of the through lines that exist in the book. And one is this over-reliance potentially on technology and the danger we have to believe that our technology gives us advantages that might not actually hold in the face of battle. So without giving away too much of the book, I would just offer the observation that the first aircraft you see in the book is a state-of-the-art F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. The last aircraft you see in the book is a old third generation kind of tin can F-18 Hornet.
So to put that in practical terms, Alex, I would say it means that we need to be mindful of using our advanced technologies and using this glittering, exquisite set of systems we've developed that link us together from satellites to the bottom of the ocean. But we ought to have a plan B. We ought to recognize that all of that, some of it, some portions of it could go away. And conversely, as war planners, we need to think about how we would use such capability offensively. And that is one of the lessons of the book. And that's one that the Chinese appear in this novel to be more capable of than the United States.
Yeah, that's certainly clear to me. It's interesting that, you know, the Navy has moved back to star navigation, and the Army is moving back to orienteering, and certainly to operating in environments where communications is not assured, where air power is not assured. And it seems like we're making some headway in that direction. It seems to me that in 2034, the trend line is, you know, the U.S. continuing to double down on technology and forgetting the lessons of Georgia in 2008 or Ukraine in 2004, and how Ukrainian forces were really destroyed and disrupted by Russia's ability to employ electronic warfare and other cyber means and so forth. But I would imagine that the military is doing a better job at accounting for these kinds of contested capabilities. Would you agree with that assessment? And if not, what more can they be doing?
No, I would agree with that assessment. And I'm so old that you can go back to the 1970s when I came out of the Naval Academy. And we were doing celestial navigation. That was our principal means of navigation. We had some electronic aids, but they were rather primitive, frankly. By the middle of my career, when I took command of a destroyer for the first time, we were kind of phasing out of celestial navigation. I don't think I had a sextant in my hand throughout my 2.5 years in command of a destroyer, nor did I particularly feel the need to do so. Now, as I look at today's Navy, I see that there are a return, as you say, Alex, correctly, to using celestial navigation, picking up that sextant again, still using signal flags to communicate between ships the way that Lord Nelson did at the Battle of Trafalgar. I think that's smart. I've coined a word for it. You can like it or not. It's primitivization. And it is the idea that you better have a plan B in case these exquisite systems go away, because if you're going to go toe-to-toe with a near peer, or in the case of 2034, decidedly a peer, or maybe a superior, you better have a plan B because those exquisite systems may go away. That's a big theme in the book, yes.
The characters in this book are very, very interesting. And in certain ways, I think, you know, Elliot was commenting on the continuous strings of narrative through the novel, but the characters seem to embody certain elements of the kind of national failure that would have resulted in a 2034 type catastrophe. Like Wisecarver comes to mind with regards to hubris, not just national exceptionalism, but hubris. I guess, could you talk about Wisecarver, Chowdhury, and some of the other characters in there and the key elements of that character that helped advance this narrative?
Well, yeah, I think whenever you're creating characters, you know, they become the accretion of all these little attributes that you're showing the reader. So, you know, someone like Wisecarver, right? I mean, it's in his name, even, you know, how he views the world as something to be divvied up. Or, you know, someone like Wedge, who's this fourth generation Marine fighter pilot. And, you know, I think he in the book very much harkens back to a classic sort of 20th century sense of American greatness that is very much on the wane, but still has a utility, right? His name Wedge itself, his call sign is, you know, Wedge being the world's oldest and simplest tool. So, you know, so within each character, you know, we hope they seem fully realized to the reader, but, you know, they're also very much a creature of the story and a creature of the societies that they are coming out of.
The character of Chowdhury is pretty interesting because he definitely believes in American exceptionalism, but he's in a place where it's unclear what the American future is, what the United States future is. And I think that's appropriate at the end of 2034. It's appropriate to today, the direction the United States will choose, whether it'll take us down this road of catastrophe or reemerge as a leader through the 21st century. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I'll make a point. First of all, I think it's important that we all note that Weiss-Carver, you know, he's the most problematic character in the book, shall we say, and he is a West Point graduate. So as an Annapolis guy, I'm required to point that out. But in seriousness, Alex, and you'll know this from your time at the National Security Council staff, so often big decisions turn on what staffers do and what they push and what gets stopped at what level. I think there are a few people that can appreciate it more than you do. And by the way, thank you for your integrity in that position at the National Security Council staff. You did great credit to your uniform and your service there. And so I really like Chowdhury. He's Indian American. He's a divorced dad. He has trouble with his mother getting childcare work, and he's trying to figure out, he's got this military guy, Bunt Hendrickson, the admiral, kind of floating around bothering him. Yet the two of them finally come together to try and right what is going terribly wrong right in front of them. I think it's a pretty compelling example of how important characters are and individual actions are in creating the outcomes in our world.
You know, it's interesting, and just to close out this point, but Weiss-Carver reminds me of maybe some leadership that I had a chance to interact with at the National Security Council.
I was really hoping you were going to say that. Good.
Yes.
And Alex, you were sure. Smelling what we were cooking.
Yeah. Yeah. I envisioned a mustache on this gentleman. But so this is fundamentally a story about the rise and fall of great powers, all the key players, Russia, China, India, figure in there. I noticed, of course, the exclusion of, the biggest enabler. And Admiral, you've talked about the importance of our alliances and multilateralism, but NATO and EU sitting out of this war, the absence of, besides India, other power centers that might emerge by 2034. Could you, I guess, shed some light on, you have to bound the story somehow, but why you chose these players as opposed to, Brazil or the EU and NATO playing a role or something of that nature?
Yeah, and you nailed it, Alex. It really is a matter of, do you want to write War and Peace and have 50 characters and a big sprawling story? Do you want to write Winds of War and War and Remembrance, 1,200 pages together by Herman Wouk describing the Second World War? Or do you want to write a beautiful, my view, a small gem of a novel and get it down to 300 pages? You've got to narrow the focus in some way. So we chose these particular characters in these particular nations. I think you could ask not only, what about the EU? What about NATO? My sense is they will probably still be important actors in 15 years' time. But I think you can also make a case they would be more offstage. Another one that springs to my mind is Japan. There isn't a big role for Japan in this thing, yet Japan is the third largest economy in the world. Yeah, it's got some demographic challenges, but over time, as robotics and artificial intelligence come in, maybe demographics are going to be somewhat less important. We'll see. Brazil is another good choice. Nigeria from the continent of Africa would be another nation that I think in 15 years could have taken a role. But you got to make some choices as you write a novel, and to get the storyline in a way that really pulls the reader forward, we wanted to put real focus, obviously, on China. But I think Iran and Russia as aligned with China, and then that role of India, those are the big geopolitical muscle movements that I think are the most intriguing to me as I look 15 years out.
I definitely agree with you. I'd say that adding NATO in would really kind of muddy up your narrative. Yeah. Because obviously NATO would have neutralized that surface action group, of Russians, and we wouldn't have had that whole moment of cable. So, you know, that's a good reason to keep NATO out of it.
Yeah, there you go.
But, you know, one of the things I was noticing was China maybe succumbing to the same kinds of, maybe earlier in the trajectory, but succumbing to the same kinds of hubris that may have led the U.S. towards this confrontation as this conflict start to spiral. Is this a story about the U.S. and China, about kind of the U.S. decline and Chinese ascent? Or is this in fact a story about great powers rising and falling, a more of a historical view with India as the emerging great power, just as Elliot pointed out, you know, picking up the pieces after World War II and emerging as the you know, superpower?
I would just say briefly, it is at its core a book that is about war and the folly that often is war.
And I would add another couple books that were kind of rattling around in my head as we worked on this were by Barbara Tuchman, who I think is not only a very strong historian, but is a peerless command of the narrative. And her two books are The March of Folly, largely about the U.S. involvement in Vietnam, an act of real hubris, I think a true tragic misadventure, but also Guns of August, about the beginning of World War I. And I think, Alex, you know your European history as well as anybody. I would say the way that Europe sort of sleptwalked into a global conflagration that only begins in 1914 to 1918 and then continues on effectively in the Second World War. It's a novel of miscalculation and hubris. Those are the two words that really spring to mind.
Admiral, I definitely appreciate, I've read The Guns of August, but I appreciate, in addition to having this conversation with you, adding to my reading list, which as a graduate student's not short, but you know, there's always room for more.
Good.
I'm curious about the kinds of lessons and takeaways that you would want young ensigns, sailors, anybody in the defense apparatus, policymakers to take away, national security practitioners, really, from reading this book. What is it that you'd want them to pay attention to, what amounts to about 13, 14 years before a plausible conflict of this nature could unfold?
I'll give you three things real quickly, and we've touched on all of them. One is, don't underestimate the possibility for a miscalculation that sets off a cycle of escalation. And that's been the story in wars for 2,000 years. Number two, if we are going to continue to compete with China, we've got to up our game in things like cyber, space, counter-stealth, counter-hypersonics. There's a military component to this. And thirdly, we got to have a strategy. We need to look at a book like this and say, okay, that's not where we want to end up. So how do we reverse engineer it? How do we bring it back to the present? How do we write a strategy that puts together not just the military instrument, but diplomacy and development, tech and culture and communications, all the things that create a holistic strategy with an economic base to all of it? Those would be my three, hopefully, policy-oriented things that come away from 2034.
It's very interesting. You're a longtime foreign policy practitioner. I am to a much smaller extent, but I guess what's interesting is, in this moment, the kind of focus that you would need for any of these types of activities is lacking, because we have so many domestic issues, underlying issues that lead to this kind of mismatch between China and the U.S. arise with a polarized society and the inability to kind of stay consistent on any particular strategy. In conceiving this book, how significant were the domestic issues, that the domestic faults in contributing to, you know, this impression of a third world war?
I think it certainly contributes to the lack of readiness that you see in the United States and our inability to, at least in the early days, provide a coherent response to this initial altercation in the South China Sea. I mean, first of all, as we've projected forward, you'll notice that the president in the book is a female, but is a female president who does not have a party, who is a political independent, because at this point, our political parties have become so dysfunctional that she is able to get elected without them. So that's the scenario you walk into. But even as the conflict escalates, what you see specific to the United States are inflection points where our leaders feel as though they are not able to make decisions that are divorced from the sometimes schizophrenic politics of the moment. You know, what I mean specifically is we do have one incident in the early on in the book where a Marine pilot is shot down and taken prisoner, and the politics around his captivity, kind of in a, you know, 1979 Desert One type situation, makes it very difficult for the president who wants to de-escalate to in fact do so. And that is played against the position that the Chinese have, which is more advantageous, in which just because of the nature of the regime, they're not subject quite as directly to those type of domestic political forces.
Yeah, I'll just add a snippet of history here and say, in that sense, it reminds me a bit of 1898, February 15th, 1898, what happens? USS Maine blows up in Havana Harbor, and it precipitates a world war between the United States and Spain. Spain is destroyed in this war. Their fleet is destroyed, and the United States embarks on a brief misadventure with colonization in Cuba and the Philippines. The point is, events, individual significant events like that become rallying cries. Remember the Maine. What the equivalent today is trending on Twitter is hashtag free wedge. And that sense of events running ahead of the political process, I think, is a reality, and it's part of this idea of miscalculation that can drag nations into significant wars.
It's interesting that what we learn about democracies and authoritarian states in reading this book, and the ability to effectively manage crises and make decisions. First of all, I'd be interested in hearing your conclusions about World War III being fought by a democracy and a authoritarian state, how the president in certain regards, you know, felt obligated to defend both actually the Chinese and the U.S. felt obligated to respond through escalation to preserve face. In one case, it's for constituencies, and in another case, it's for national pride. But I also find it interesting that, you know, there's a concerted effort towards enabling, you know, while I was in government, towards enabling decision makers with the kinds of tools to compete against near peer authoritarian states. And that requires a devolution of authorities, capabilities that we probably are not going to experience in an era of polarization where there is less trust and confidence by the political parties of various actors, and how that's likely to really hamper us in being able to either fight or avert this kind of situation.
You know, my view of that is too soon to tell. We're all still dealing with the emergence of social networks, the speed with which they move ideas, the speed with which they move misinformation. There's always been that tendency in international relations, but this is still relatively new technology. This is really over the last decade. And so I think round one has in fact gone to the authoritarian regimes who have used these new emergent tools very effectively to undermine democracy, undermine elections. And of course, Russia used it very effectively in 2016. I'm not so sure that they're going to win round two or round three. I think we are, in fact, beginning to wake up to this. But Alex, you're right to point out the countervailing argument is going to be that there are some, particularly in the extremes of the political spectrum in the United States, who will find some advantage in using some of these tools of misinformation. So we've got work to do in education, in ensuring that the public gradually learn how to use that flow of information from that supercomputer they're carrying around in their pocket or their purse. That needs to start very early, by the way. Average age of a child when he or she receives an iPhone is 11 and a half years old. That is really soon if you're not going to couple it with significant education. And I would argue that education needs to continue into middle school, into high school, even into your college years. And frankly, the public needs some education as well. So we have work to do, but over time, I think the good will outweigh the bad in these social networks and these tools of information. We'll see.
What about this broader argument about democracies being besieged as a result of the end of the Cold War and U.S. leadership? There seemed to be a surge in democracies, and the trajectory just in the past few years really has shifted in the reverse. What conclusions might you draw from the world of 2034 based on today projecting forward?
Let me project back for a minute and just point out that 100 years ago, there were like 12 democracies in the world. And today there are, depending on how you score the term, but today there are somewhere between 100 and 120. The number of democracies has increased by tenfold. Secondly, it's of course important to point out that, well, Russia and China are both huge authoritarian countries. Well, newsflash, they've always been authoritarian countries. They don't create more points on the authoritarian scoreboard, whereas meanwhile, many other countries have moved toward democracy. It's absolutely true that over the last 5 to 10 years, I think there has been some backstepping, and I would tie it to what we just talked about, the ability of authoritarian leaders to use these emerging social networks and cyber tools to suppress portions of their population. But I think the long throw of human history, the trend lines remain pretty much on the side of democracies. I'm kind of with Churchill, you know, the quote, the democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others. And why is that? It's because in the end, nobody wants a boss. No one wants to get told what to do. And I think that'll continue to be the case. There'll be some backing and forthing. But now to bring it to 2034 and projecting ahead, we need to be mindful that our most important peer and competitor 15 years from now is kind of undoubtedly going to be China. And I think it's highly unlikely that China will change its form of government. So it becomes all the more important that we work with our allies, partners, and friends. And I would say India becomes an enormous swing vote, if you will, in the global system as between democracy and totalitarianism.
You know, Admiral, it's interesting, and Elliot, that if you had wanted this to, I'm not going to spoil anything, but if you had wanted this to be a Hollywood production, you would have had a different ending. But you felt it very important to kind of end on the tone you did. Can you explain a little bit what was your thinking behind, you know, in order for it to be an effective cautionary tale, you had to end it the way you did. But could you illustrate your thinking a little bit on this?
Yeah, that's funny. I actually thought about it a little bit differently. You know, I don't want to spoil the ending, but we very much had the end in mind. But ultimately, listen, I try to write the types of books that I enjoy reading, and I don't enjoy reading books that are predictable. And the stakes for this novel are set up front, which is it is a war, right, between the United States and China. So that leads the reader to believe that either the United States or China is going to, quote, win this war, whatever that looks like. I would only offer that when the reader gets to the end of the book, that is not the ending that occurs. And so my hope is that, and our hope is that the book upsets what maybe are your expectations going into it. And speaking of myself as a reader, I love it when a book upsets my expectations in a somewhat surprising way. And I think it's our hope that that's what you get at the end of 2034.
And I would just add to that, that in that sense, characters, the people are so important here. And the final scene, again, we don't want to give it away, but one of the American characters has a seemingly small decision to make that is actually an enormous symbolic decision. And I love books that leave me remembering characters. And I always say my favorite book in many ways is Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea. And I can't tell you a lot of the details anymore of exactly what happened in the novel, but I sure do remember that fisherman, Santiago, who was destroyed but not defeated, in Hemingway's words. And I think that's a big part of the book for me, was having the characters work their way through this horrific situation, and how do their stories come out. I think it's a very moving part of the book, the final coda, where we show you, we turn over the last card for each of these characters, some who have, if you will, better endings than others. Let's put it that way.
Sure. You know, Admiral, I'm going to go ahead and predict that this is going to make it on a number of reading lists. This is a very thought-provoking look into a prospective future, and I applaud your effort, yours and Elliot's effort here, and I wanted to thank you for giving me an opportunity to interview you and Elliot, and wish you luck on your upcoming release. What date is that again?
It just came out, and as we sit here doing this podcast, it is number 7 nationally on the combined fiction, nonfiction list of Amazon. So would be a little higher if there weren't a couple Dr. Seuss books ahead of us. But
congratulations.
Yeah, we're off to a good start. Stay tuned. And you said a minute ago that it doesn't have a Hollywood ending. Let's wait and see if Hollywood is interested. I think it's a very well-told tale, but that's for others to decide. Alex, thank you. And as I said earlier, thank you for your service. I mean that so sincerely. Hemingway, we talked about him earlier, said that courage is grace under pressure. You displayed that every day in your voyage through the National Security Council staff, and I'm proud of you. So thank you for taking time with us.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with Brookings Institution. Please share the Lawfare Podcast and give us a 5-star review in iTunes. Go to thelawfarestore.com for brand new Lawfare pens, lanyards, t-shirts, and socks. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell, and our studio engineer is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thank you for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.